To this episode of the Uncharted 80s podcast. Once again, it's myself, Martin, here with my good buddy, Noel. Hey, good to see you, Noel. How you doing?
Andrew, mate.
And as you know, Noel, we're the Uncharted 80s. And for those listening for the first time, it's all about shining a light on the bands that perhaps we didn't feel had that spotlight previously. It's not necessarily about chart success, but it's about, do our listeners know the story of the bands? Do they know the music?
Yeah, so Uncharted as in kind of like unexplored or, you know, not known or not discovered in some parts, yeah.
Yes, that's exactly it. Yes, Uncharted territory type thing, yeah. So, Noel, today we've got a treat. We're going to be talking about a band called The Passions. Now, some people may not have heard about The Passions, but I'm pretty sure they'll have heard the about their song. They had one huge hit, which was called I'm in Love with a German Film Star. Now, Noel, I know you've done a bit of research on them, but how much do you know?
Honestly, I did a bit of research and most of the stuff that I found out was kind of links to the band from other stuff, which I can talk about.
So the band itself, where they were around from the sort of back end of the 70s, 1978 to 83. And I'll just give you a quick run through of the band members so you know who they are. They were Barbara Gogan on guitar and vocals, Claire Bidwell on bass guitar, Richard Williams on drums, Dak Dyed on guitar, Mitch Barker on vocals, and then Clive Timperley on guitar. And David Agar, who actually we're going to be speaking to later on in the episode, joined on bass guitar in 1980. So it'd be great to get to hear his version about their journey. But I thought we'd just do a quick run through of their history.
And on that note, actually, I talked about, I'll chip in here and there with little bits I might have found out. So Clive Timperley, he was living in a squat, actually, I think he was living in the same squat as Joe Strummer, who became the Clash frontman. The Passions themselves were living on a street that was squatted. And the other side of Notting Hill was his place where Joe Strummer was staying. And the band, the 101ers, they all came from a house which was 101 Walterton Road. And the band is named after the house number, 101. So people actually thought it was to do with George Orwell and stuff like that, Room 101. But actually, no, it's actually named after the house. Yeah, so Joe, obviously the 101ers were playing around more kind of pub rocky type stuff, I think, that we were talking about before when we talked about Nine Below Zero. And what happened for Joe was the 101ers were supported by the Sex Pistols, would you believe? And he saw them and he thought, wow, this is fire for punk, which has led Joe into the Clash. So there's a little bit of a link there.
Yeah, thank you. Because it looks like the Passions themselves, the sort of idea of the band came from Claire Bidwell on bass, who then recruited some of the other people in the band. They obviously went through what looks like a few sort of name changes. They were called the Derelicts, and who were actually one of those sort of pub rock R&B bands that you were talking about. Then they changed their name to the Youngsters, then Rivers of Passion, and then they finally got on to the Passions, the name that we know and love.
So just like the Pogues went from Pogue Mahone to the Pogues, and the Southern Death Cult went to the Cult, and so on.
Yeah, that's right. Obviously a few iterations there for them. But back in the 70s, in March 79, they issued their first single. I mean, double A-sided single, interestingly enough, called Needles and Pills and Body and Soul. Single came out in March 79 and clearly helped get a recording contract with Fiction Records.
Fantastic. Well, actually, interestingly enough, that was actually sung by Mitch and as a vocalist. But unfortunately, he then broke his leg. He had to take quite a bit of time out. The band wanted to continue the momentum, so they got Barbara to do the vocals while he was away, and actually realised they liked the sound of her more than him. Sadly for him, it kind of effectively made him redundant, and he ended up leaving the band.
Ah, and that makes sense because Body and Soul, double A-sided with Needles and Pills, so the song Body and Soul, that side is sung by Barbara, and you can definitely hear that there's a sort of passion sound. Because also at that time they recorded their first of their three Peel John Peel sessions. As you know, John Peel's been one of those people that all the bands that we've seemed to have come across on our podcast so far has had a massive impact on and had a link with.
Yeah, well, yeah, and definitely
And
gave everybody a push, didn't it?
well, yeah, definitely gave everybody a push, really big. But it was so critical. After that, they did their first album, Michael and Miranda, and that was released in 1980. And you can hear a difference in sound to that of that album to their next two albums that they did, which we'll come on to. Their second single was called Hunted.
Thank you.
Now, Noel, that song is a great, great song. I would say in my top five songs of all time.
Wow, that's something. I mean, you've got a massive record collection.
The album Michael Miranda, that was produced by the head of Fiction Records, actually, Chris Parry.
Now, I know about Chris Parry. He had quite an interesting past. He was born in New Zealand and he was in a band that got to number one in New Zealand. Then he moved to London and got offered a job in Polydor in A&R. And he went to Polydor with a few different bands that he'd found. You know, his job is to find new bands, and they kind of rejected them all. But at that time, this is kind of 74-ish, 74, 75, punk was starting to kick off, and he took a real interest in that. He went to look for all the early punk bands and discovered all about them. And he went to Polydor. He went in 76 and he said, "Right, I want you to sign these two bands. They're going to be massive. One's the Sex Pistols and one's the Clash." And Polydor said, "Nah, don't bother." So they rejected those two bands, which obviously, you know, are huge bands really in terms of rock and roll history. But in January 77, he got a tip off from the Future Pogues frontman, Shane McGowan, to check out The Jam. So he actually checked them out, loved them, and he signed them the next February, and he co-produced the first three albums of The Jam. And then in 78, what happened was that because obviously he'd been disgruntled with Polydor, Parry started his own record label called Fiction. It was a sub-brand of Polydor, but he obviously had the controls on it because he was running it. And as well as signing The Passions, he signed another band that became huge, and that was, of course, The Cure. And he actually produced their first album, which is a fantastic album, Three Imaginary Boys. And one other little thing about him, actually, in 92, along with Sammy Jacobs, sorry, he actually launched a radio station, XFM. So quite a rich kind of history there.
Yeah, right. Because the Passions themselves, they did a tour with The Cure in 1980. And actually, that sort of brings them to the sort of brings us to the middle of 1980. And that's when David Agar joined. As you know, we're going to be talking to him later on. But that also coincided with the band being dropped by Fiction Records. So it'd be interesting to ask him, you know, what he knew about that.
Okay, guess not enough record sales.
You know, maybe David would be able to tell us that.
Yeah, because they would have done their second Peel session by then. So, yeah, it's interesting that momentum wasn't still going, but hey.
You know, that second Peel session covered songs like the aforementioned Hunted, Absentee, Lies, and a track called Real Mean, also a very similar song to Hunted, but also great. Now, that change from Fiction to Polydor, I think, really, in the whole sort of events of the band, actually meant, you know, it was more of a positive thing because it meant they got to use the Polydor's in-house demo studio. And they actually met there the engineer and producer, Pete Wilson.
Oh, now you see, now you've got me going again. So Pete Wilson, also a massive Jam fan. Pete Wilson was the Jam's producer for the last five singles, including Town Called Malice and the last studio album, The Gift. Then he went on to work with Weller on the Style Council and co-produced the first three Style Council albums. So he has a massive impact in terms of, you know, Jam fans like myself. So yeah, big name.
Yeah, big name. So he put together a song with them called The Swimmer. They released The Swimmer as their third single. It's a great song and it got favorable reviews, but obviously, unfortunately, it didn't have what you might term as many record sales.
Interesting, because it at the end of in November in 1980 they did another Peel session then, and that song The Swimmer was on that as well, and with some other songs as well. So yeah, it's obviously it's a great song, and it's a shame that, you know, it's still being pushed but didn't seem to get anywhere. It's a shame.
But success clearly was just around the corner.
Okay.
Because the fourth single, I'm In Love With a German Film Star, which is one I suspect that a lot of our listeners will know. It was a particularly big hit for them, reaching number 25 in the chart. And that was about a guy called Steve Connolly.
That's right, yeah. So I looked into that, actually. So Steve was a roadie. He roadied for The Clash. And for a while, he lived in the rehearsal room with Joe Strummer. Joe keeps coming up, doesn't he? But after a bit of a fallout with Mick Jones of The Clash, he went to work with the Sex Pistols, roadieing for them instead. Now, what had happened was, while he was with The Clash, he'd been interviewed for a German documentary called Punk in London. I'm kind of assuming here that he speaks a bit of German, given the rest of the story, because after the Pistols split, the German director contacted him. He ended up moving to Germany and started acting, doing TV roles in Germany. And he actually then did some film roles as well, at least one film role we know of. And hence, that's where the song came from, The German Film Star. After his time in Germany, he actually became a sound technician for live gigs and did stuff like Bob Dylan, The Pretenders, The Undertones, and so on. So yeah, he's done a lot of stuff, Joe. So Steve, very interesting. But I want to watch Joe as well, one last time. I keep bringing him in, one last time. As you know, I live in Spain. Did you know that in Granada, Joe used to spend a lot of time in Andalusia, actually. And when he retired from music, he moved to Andalusia. In Granada, there's a monument called Placeta de Joe Strummer. How interesting, eh?
Have you been there?
I've seen it, yeah. Been there.
Oh,
It's near
right.
the
Brilliant.
Alhambra, actually, the Alhambra Palace. Yeah.
Ah, yes. Okay. Well, yeah, that song, it was sort of everywhere at the time. Got lots of radio play. There were People's Choice on Capital Radio, and they had two Top of the Pops appearances. Interestingly enough, those two Top of the Pops appearances were in the same month in February, 1981.
That's, I mean, like, given that all that promotion and all that credit that it got, Single of the Week and so on, and to Top of the Pops, only getting to 25 seems a bit strange. You'd have thought it would have got a bit higher, wouldn't you?
And that's what I mean. Some of our previous episodes, I'm thinking particularly of the It's Immaterial one, of
Yeah.
course, where Siren Records didn't print enough of their song Driving Away From Home, and that sort of stalled at number 16.
I mean, that's incredible. You've got a record out and you don't put it in the final to sell. I mean, that was just shocking.
So I don't know what the story is there, but David hopefully will be able to tell us that.
Yeah.
And also, interestingly enough, there's another link to one of our other podcasts. Which was about the Screen 3 one. So,
Oh, wow, Screen Three.
off the back of those two Top of the Pops experiences, I think at one point the Passions were due on to do the Top of the Pops experience, record that, and then to get back to a gig in Norwich, they were a bit late, which enabled Screen 3 apparently to fill in and have that second support slot. So, a nice little link there to our previous episode 1 and episode 2, for those that are interested in going back and listening to it. I would highly, highly recommend that one.
Brilliant, yeah.
They then tried to get some more recording sessions with Pete Wilson. But as you quite rightly say, around then he was working closely with the Jam. And then they couldn't quite manage that. So, they had to move on. And they had a follow up single that was produced by Nigel Gray called Skin Deep. Obviously, Nigel Gray did a lot of work with the Police,
Yes, yeah.
and he also went on to produce the band's second album, 30,000 Feet Over China.
Okay.
And that was released in September 81. And then when we talked about Clive Timperley at the beginning, he actually left the band at the back end of 1981, and it was during one of the Italian legs of the tour. And get this, Noel, the tour was called the Tour Till We Crack Tour. And apparently, he left because of serious political differences.
Well, see, I'm not sure. I know he left in Verona, and I'm not sure whether the tour had finished then, even. It might even be mid-tour.
Yeah, that's a good question for David when we talk to him.
That'd be interesting to find out, won't it?
So post that, they had some follow-up singles, Africa Mine. They recruited a couple more people. Kevin Armstrong came in, a guy called Jeff Smith, who was a keyboard player. And then they went on to do a third album. They did called Sanctuary. Now that was produced by a guy called Mick Glossop, who had previously done some work with the Skids on Absolute Game.
Great band.
And they did have a single from that called Jump for Joy. Great song, but as we know, the Sanctuary album d didn't really sell. So once again, they're touring Europe and the US, got some TV appearances, Old Grey Whistle Tests in the in on BBC Two in the UK, a programme called Whatever You Want on Channel 4. I must admit, I'm not actually sure about that one. I don't know if you've heard of that.
I don't know that one. It's not something that's familiar to me, but hey.
And that then gets us into the middle of 83. And, you know, sad times, Noel. That's when they played their final show at the London's Marquee Club.
Yes.
And that sort of seemed to be their last ever show. They did try and get together and had, I think, did a little bit of rehearsal in 2008 as a bit of a reunion. But I don't really think, from what I can see or read, it generated anything.
Yeah, it's interesting because one thing I did, little snippet I found out after the band had split, was Richard Williams actually appeared on the TV programme, which is a UK music quiz show called Never Mind the Buzzcocks. And part of that programme, they have a kind of an ID parade. They line up, I think, four people, and one of them is an ex-pop star. And the panel have to work out who was the ex-pop star. So none of them identified him, which I don't know if that's a good or a bad thing. Does he win or not? I'm not sure.
I wonder how he did feel about that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So after that, and, you know, in the last few years, their one big hit, German film star, has actually had in the last few years a bit of a resurgence. A lot of cover versions of the band, and you can find those online. You know, bands like the Foo Fighters, the Pet Shop Boys, Dubstar, lots of many others. There's about a dozen covers of it out there. And they've had a bit more interest recently.
Cool. Cool.
And some of their albums have been re-released on a couple of record labels, one of them Cherry Red, who obviously done some work with some of the other bands that we've dealt with as well.
Yeah, yeah. They always pick out some great old bands, don't they?
Okay, Noel. Well, that's pretty much a run-through of the band's history.
Great stuff.
Let's now have a chat with David and find out the answers to some of those questions. So, David, welcome to the podcast.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Excellent. So David, I have a question for you, actually, about before the Passions. Now, I read something on the internet which could be wrong, but I'll ask the question. So I read this really interesting article which said that a David Wardell, which I'm assuming was you, was in a band playing around London for a short period. And when they split up, another band basically adopted the name and used the name for themselves. And that band was Spandau Ballet. Is there any truth to that?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Myself, I mean, we actually came from Bedfordshire, where we formed. My best friend at school played guitar, Mark Robinson on vocals, and we changed drummers. We picked up a drummer in London when we came to London, Gordon. Mick and I came up with the name in 77 or something. We wanted a name with contrasts in it. So the idea of ballet being something flowing and beautiful, and then Mick had said something ballet, and I went, what about Spandau, you know, because we were both into all the military stuff. So he did a poster, and he still got it, and there's a book which a journalist wrote who did all the research, and there's photographs in there. And our one and only gig in London actually was a Hope and Anchor. But yes, I lived in a house with some people who were big in the sort of Blitz scene, where all that started. We didn't do anything about it at the time. We were more just flabbergasted at the cheek of it. But and I could say unkind things, but I won't. I think the name is probably the most creative thing about them personally. But that is our story. Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing. That's incredible.
I'm glad you did that research.
I think the word you use, borrowed, is the polite way of putting it, and I think probably best to stick with that. I mean,
yeah.
They did go into a flurry of panic when people started talking about it, and different members or people associated with them came out with different stories about how they invented the name and who invented the name and where they got it. And someone said they saw it written in a club in Berlin, and someone else said they saw it on the underground, and someone said this and that. And so I think they were kind of embarrassed eventually. There you go. What are you going to do?
How interesting is that, though? How interesting. Mm.
What a story. What a story. So following that then, David, I know you didn't start out with the Passions, but how did you come to join them? How did it all come about?
Well, I was kind of lucky. I mean, I lived in this house in East Ham that had the aforementioned fashion people who were in the Blitz Club and everything, but I lived there as well with my girlfriend then at the time, Deanne Pearson, who was starting to write for the NME, And she had a few contacts, and we then moved to Finsbury Park, and we lived right next to nearby Robbie Miller from Sounds, and people like Adele March Harrison, was that her name? Another journalist who lived there. So I had these kind of contacts, and one night we all went to this club called the Y Studios to see Echo and the Bunnymen.
Cool.
Which was in the basement of the big YMCA on Tottenham Court Road. Quite a big venue, holds about 500 people. And Adele said, "Oh, the Passions, they've lost their bass player. You've got to come and meet them, you know." And she had met them or something. So she took me to meet Richard and Barbara. I don't think Clive was there. I think it was Richard and Barbara. Clive may have been there. And they were sat in a corner looking very disconsolate and sorry for themselves because Claire, their bass player, had left. And soon afterwards, they'd been dropped by Fiction, their label. So they were pretty down in the dumps and they had gigs coming up. They had gigs booked, you know. So I bounced up, you know, all full of youthful vigor and was introduced. And they said, "Well, we're doing auditions in a week. If you can learn some of our songs and come along." And so I did. I learned the album. All except one track, which I found very difficult, which was called Obsession. But I learned all the rest and turned up, and I could hear the person in before me, and I thought, no, they got no chance. You know, I really wanted this. You know, I mean, it was I really wanted to be in a rock and roll band, and I thought, you know, th this I'm going to, you know, I'm going to get this. And yeah, I mean, we played. I knew most of the album, so we could do quite a few numbers, and they seemed quite impressed that I'd made the effort, you know. And we played together well, and you know, it's great. And so they said, "Okay, well, you're the only serious contender from the auditions, and we've got gigs coming in 2 weeks." And I'd exaggerated my past experience, you know, one support slot at the Hope and Anchor turned into sort of mysteriously quite a few fictitious gigs I said I'd done. But yeah, so we rehearsed, and if memory serves me correct, we had 2 weeks before the first gig. And I think before the gig, and we'd been rehearsing every day, they had their own rehearsal studio in Harlesden, an old strip club or something, and so they could keep all their gear set up, and we could just work every day, and it all sounded good. And Barbara did say, "Look, it's only fair, you should join the band." So I said, "Okay." And I was signing on at the time, and they'd lost their deal, and they had no money. So that's why I used my middle name, because I didn't. I thought if because they said, "Oh, we're going to have to do an interview. It'll be in the press," you know. And I thought, "Oh God, the Dole will find out I used my middle name."
All right.
Silly
So
me.
that's why it's David Agar rather than David Warden. Yeah.
But yeah, that
Interesting.
was the thing. I mean, we clicked straight away. We even started writing songs almost immediately. I think Someone Special was written during that 2 week rehearsal period. Just happened, you know. We It was the thing I loved about the Passions. It was so organic. We would just write songs from jamming, or someone would have a couple of chords, or Barbara would have a few words, and we'd just jam the idea around, and a song would develop, you know. And yeah, so the first gig was again at that same place I'd met them, the Y Studios, and I was dead nervous. I think they all were, because they thought, oh God, what, you know, how's this going to go? But actually, it was kind of fine. And then we had another one at the ICA the next week. And then very shortly after that, a festival in Holland. So
Wow.
my fourth ever gig, and my third with the Passions, was in front of 50,000 people at the New Pop Festival, with the Ramones and all this. So yeah, it was a roller coaster ride. It was really like whoosh, you know, very exciting.
Baptism of fire. Wow.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, I
Yeah.
mean, I was a cocky young so-and-so. I was only 20. And it's what I'd wanted to do. I was steeped in rock and roll culture and history. You know, I'd been reading The Enemy and The Melody Maker every week since I was 12. You know, and I used to go to gigs all the time. So, and it was interesting because one of my favourite bands had been The Clash, and I'd seen them loads of times. And there was this connection with Clive, having been in the 101ers with Joe Strummer.
Yes. Yeah.
So I felt I was plugged straight into a bit of chunk of rock and roll history, you know. It was, and Barbara and Richard, they'd been in the Derelicts and they'd done all this other stuff. And so it was really, yeah, I learned a hell of a lot very quickly, you know.
Fantastic.
What were those other gigs like then, in the early days?
Well, pretty, in London, they could play places up to 500 sort of capacity and get a decent crowd. And at the Y Studios, and then at the ICA, good crowds, pretty enthusiastic. We got slapped. Paul Morley gave us a very bad review for the ICA gig. Though there's a really nice picture of me actually used to go with the gig. And then going to do a festival, I mean, that was mind blowing. I mean, you could feel the ground moving. There were so many people. You could feel the ground backstage, behind the stage. You could feel tremors in the ground, you know. And you couldn't see the audience because the back of the stage was all partitioned. So you had to go up a ladder, like a staircase. And it was only when you got up the staircase and you went through these big curtains, and then suddenly there's 50,000 people.
Wow.
And there's some fantastic photographs of us taken from behind where you can see the whole crowd. I don't remember. I don't remember being a bit nervous, obviously, before the show, but I just loved it. I after the initial couple of gigs, the nerves on stage pretty well went, and I was okay. And just loved it, just really enjoyed it, you know.
Brilliant.
Great stuff.
I know you joined just after the Fiction Records change, but what do you know what the reason was for them coming off of of that label?
I don't know. I mean, I think they were worried that Claire had been quite instrumental in some of the songwriting, which she had. I think she'd written quite a lot of the lyrics, maybe. And I think they thought she was too important for the band to carry on. To be, you know, I mean, they were distributed, Fiction were distributed through Polydor. So we did have contacts. And very quickly after those initial gigs, we put out feelers to Polydor and they invited us to make a demo. And we'd already written some new material, Someone Special, and I think possibly The Swimmer, which we then demoed. And on the strength of that, quite quickly, they gave us a deal. I think they felt, you know, I mean, having a new young member, because I was 10 years or more younger than the rest, I think that gave them a bit of a shot in the arm, the band, you know. And I didn't look too bad. I think, you know, the image was quite good. So, yeah, it seemed to happen quite seamlessly, really.
So I want to ask you, so Steve Connolly, the German film star, did you actually know him personally or more by reputation?
I met him, I did meet him. He was drunk in a pub, we were probably drunk as well around that time, but I didn't know the full story. I knew that Barbara had known him, and Richard seemed a bit disgruntled, didn't seem to like him. I can't remember, but it all but I did meet him, but I didn't really understand the significance until a bit later. But I think what really is important about that, and I feel quite strongly now about songwriting, it's really good to have some basis of reality to as a starting point. And the way Barbara sort of extrapolated from this thing that had happened, her relationship with him in Berlin, I think it was Berlin, into, you know, the sort of romanticized version, I think it worked really well, you know. But no, I only met him the once, I think. I think I met him maybe years and years later as well, but I didn't really know him, no.
And did the song come about from one of those demo sessions, or was the song sort of fully formed by the time that you guys all got it and
No, I
recorded
mean,
it?
and it's the easiest song that we ever wrote to put together. And because normally they take a few days jamming around, you know, playing. We were in the Clink rehearsal studios in Clink Street, which was indeed an old prison in the
Yeah,
old.
Borough Market. Yeah.
Yeah, no, very run down in those days. It was a quite big, huge, subterranean, damp-smelling cellar, but it was big and we had space and it was fine. And Richard was sat at the drums smoking, and Barbara was off, sat down with a notepad writing something. And Clive and I were just stood there playing around, and I can't remember exactly how it started. He probably played a nice chord, maybe the G chord. And I just started going do 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 do. You know, I felt that was quite, you know. And then it quickly progressed to the three chords. Clive will tell you that musically it's very interesting, not being a four chord structure, but a three chord structure. There's a name for it. I can't remember what it is. But he said that's a quite interesting, it has a sort of internal tension that keeps it going round, you know. So we played this for a couple of minutes and then we stopped. And then Richard was still sat smoking. He didn't join in. And then Barbara said, no, don't stop. And we went, oh, okay. So we carried on playing and she was writing some stuff. And then after a few more minutes, we stopped again, and Richard was still sat there, finished his cigarette, and said, well, what have you got, Barbara? And she said, I'm in love with a German film star. And Richard said, that's a hit single. Everybody keep working. And so she wrote a bit more. Clive and I just kept playing, and then she came up to the mic, started singing. Richard joined in very tentatively on the drums, and that was it. Took 20 minutes, and
Wow.
that was literally it. That was it. By after 20 minutes, we had an admittedly rough but recognizable German film star.
Wow,
It
that's incredible.
was quite astonishing how quick it was, and it was like meant to be. You know, it just all came together.
Because Pete Wilson has got on record as saying that the song sort of almost wrote itself, you know.
No, he's quite right. I mean, it was so easy. And I mean, to be fair, there's, you know, it's fairly simple. There's no massive changes in it. But Clive's layers of guitar, and Clive could play pretty much all of it live. I mean, it is quite astonishing. And on that track, he particularly played to the echo that he used strengths. He used a particular kind of echo that you could do sound on sound. So you could set up one sort of loop almost, and then you could play on top of it as well. And Clive is a masterful guitarist. I mean, for a song like that, he's perfect. He's very precise and clean in the way he plays. But yes, it was definitely the easiest song for us to write. And Pete Wilson did, I mean, he helped with some arrangement ideas. And also, there's a couple of little touches, things he put in as a vocoder triggered by the hi-hat. But yeah. He's quite right. It did almost write itself, yeah.
So how does it go from that demo to like becoming the most enormous hit that it was?
Well, we'd had one single on Polydor, The Swimmer, Too Fast. I listen to it now and I go, that's way too fast, you know. And we'd worked with Pete Wilson, and they had their own studio, Polydor. It was only a 16 track, but it was 2-inch tape and it was all well run. And Pete was a great engineer stroke producer. And he used to do all the demos, but he worked with different artists. So we'd done our demo with him. We did The Swimmer, and he added a lot to that. The sound was great. So it was natural we'd do German Film Star. And when they heard the rough demo, Polydor, everybody pricked up their ears. It's amazing how this kind of crackle of excitement goes through the building, you know. And so very quickly, we then re-recorded with Pete Wilson. And everybody was like, oh yeah. You know, everybody, they said this is going to be a hit. The trouble was, and why it wasn't a bigger hit, the people who controlled the purse strings refused to press more than 250,000.
Wow.
So, and there was a 2-week turnaround on getting more records pressed, covers into shops, and it sold those 250,000 in 3 days.
That's incredible. So we had
Yeah.
exactly the same story. Was it It's Immaterial we spoke
Yeah,
to, Martin?
it's immaterial. Yeah.
They didn't print enough vinyl. And because you paid Top of the Pops twice in the
Yeah.
same month. But of
Yeah.
course, I guess by the second time you hadn't got any product to sell because they hadn't
That's
actually printed any.
in a nutshell, yeah. I mean, it takes 2 weeks to turn around. They in a panic then printed up, you know, huge amounts more, but it had lost its momentum. And you know, after 2 weeks, people think there's a new record they want to get, there's another one, you know. I think it would have been top 10 if they'd printed 500,000 or more straight away. I think it would have just gone whoosh, because it sold that first week, within days it had sold out. So yeah, I think it would have gone higher. I mean,
That's incredible.
21 is as high as it got. Most people think it must have got higher because it did get massive airplay. And there was 1 week when the only record played more than us, because they come out with all these charts, all these, you know, spreadsheets, all the
Stats, yeah.
stats. There was only one record played more than us on British radio, and it was In the Air Tonight by Phil Collins.
Wow.
So it was everywhere all the time. So I mean, Polydor got some things right, but unfortunately, I think they had very cautious accountants because they had to sign off, and I think that's how they sold it to us, that the accountants had said they wouldn't sign off on more than 250,000. You know, I mean, these silly little things. But it doesn't affect the sort of legacy of it, because the amount of people with memories of it, and it's still played on the radio all the time. I mean, I get texts from people, oh, you're on this, you're on, you know, Six Music or this or that. That in a way is not diminished by the fact it didn't sell as many as it should have done.
What was the Top of the Pops experience like for you?
Well, interesting. It's much smaller than you think from watching it on TV, you know. And I'd always thought that the DJs were a strange group of people. You know, I always thought they seemed a bit odd, you know. I think we had Simon Bates. I think it was Simon Bates. It was a strange, there's only about 20 kids there, and you think it's a huge crowd, but this is 20 kids, and they have different bands set up on different stages, and the people with the headphones and the clipboards shoo them along to go and stand in front of the next stage. But when the DJ turn, you know, waves his arm and points towards the new band, they're only about 3 feet away. It's like really, actually really small. It's a
Oh,
strange
wow.
effect of the cameras that it made the place look quite big, you know. But it was fine. We got a clothing budget from Polydor, so we all rushed out to Johnson's on the King's Road and bought bits of tap from there. I got this very natty fake leopard skin waistcoat with leather bits and skull buttons, you know, very nice. And I was kind of nervous, and if I see it now, I can tell I was kind of quite self-conscious, you know. But yeah, it was interesting, and it was quite good because the Passions lived in Shepherd's Bush, so we were literally around the corner. But when we'd it didn't come out till we were on tour. We were doing a gig in Leeds the first time it was shown. So we went to a pub, a local pub. I thought we'll go to a pub after the sound check. We'll go and go and see. And they had something else on. So we said to the manager, "Could you put change to BBC One for Top of the Pops because we're on it?" And he went, "Okay." And he put it on. And when we came on, he went, "That's not you." But there you go. Yeah. So well, it was a very interesting experience. We did Old Grey Whistle Test. The Oxford Roadshow was probably the best. That was a BBC in Manchester, and we played live
Manchester, yeah.
on that, which I'm quite amazed about. Yeah, so but it was interesting to have seen it all those years and then finally be there. Yeah, it was kind of interesting.
We can't get over. And then we've spoken to a lot of bands of that sort of rise, fall, and stall sort of influence that Top of the Pops had. I think a lot of people today perhaps just don't realize the impact that it had on the music scene and the bands.
Yeah, I mean, there was nothing else really like it. And bearing in mind, there were still only what, three channels on the TV and no internet, no. So it really was the primary sort of, I mean, record companies were really, really keen and worked very hard to get their bands on, But I think having a record that just sounded amazing and people knew was going to be a hit, I think that gets you on there pretty much. I think it was it's a shame we didn't come up with any more as good as that, but
One of the first bands that we spoke to actually was Screen Three, and I think they supported you on one of the slots. And I think it was off the back of one of those Top of the Pops appearances where perhaps you didn't quite, you were a bit late back to the gig, and therefore they had a they could have a support slot. I don't know if you remember Screen Three from Norwich.
I don't remember offhand. I do remember after Top of the Pops, because we did have a gig booked that night. That is correct. And so Polydor hired these two enormous Daimler limousines, which were big enough to take our guitars and flight cases and us, and drove to, I think, was it Norwich, Norfolk somewhere?
Yeah, Norwich. Yeah,
No, you're right.
Norwich.
So I remember we roared up there, literally into the dressing room, tuning guitars straight on stage. So I didn't see the support bands. Yeah, that was all part of the sort of package, the excitement of the day.
One of the questions that we asked the Vapors, obviously they had a big hit called Turning Japanese, and we sort of asked them about whether or not having that one big hit was a blessing or a curse. How do you look back on that now?
I think if we'd had a manager. And the reasons why we didn't have a manager were our fault. We were just too obstinate and untrusting to. If we'd had a proper manager, they would have set us straight and said, "What do you want? Do you want this to continue? In other words, do you want a career of some sort?" And they would have told us, "I want another two or three German film stars." Pretty similar records that mined the same theme that would keep you. And we didn't have that. And the second thing was that we assumed and were told originally that we would do the album, which was scheduled to be recorded quite soon, with Pete Wilson. And then, because he was a Polydor employee, a major artist on the label decided they wanted to put him under exclusive
The
contract.
jam, yeah.
Well, I'm saying nothing, but yeah. So took him away from us when we couldn't have him. And we were devastated because actually the experience of all the recording we'd done with him, two singles, some B-sides, demos, he'd become like a fifth member. To get that German film star was a product of five people, equally, I would say. So we were kind of devastated and we became a bit disgruntled, and our manager would have fought for us, would have done something, and we got presented without really much choice, Nigel Gray. And we thought, well, he's worked with the police, he worked with the Banshees, but he was way down in Surrey, so it meant driving every day, which wasn't good. Barbara especially didn't feel good about the long drive to get there before we could do any work, and it wasn't a happy experience really. He wasn't he just wasn't the same thing as Pete Wilson. So it's hard to put myself back in the mindset, but I think we were confused and a bit disgruntled and not focused on what we should be doing. So we did something completely different for the next single. I mean, crazy, you know. There's all the what ifs, and we should have done this and that. I mean, I don't brood on it much anymore. I just think of the positives, but we made mistakes. Yeah, we definitely made mistakes. And it was a lot of it down to us. But I mean, that thing of Pete Wilson being taken away was a blow. It was a real blow because he really got us and we worked really well with him. And he got a great sound, you know, especially with Barbara's voice and Clive's guitar. Just excellent, you know. So yeah, that it was a blow.
So that album, 30,000 Feet Over China, is that something now that you look back on and perhaps weren't happy as a band?
Well, I mean, the songs are very varied, and we do like, and I love some of the songs on it. To me, I can hear the difference between there's German film stars on it, and then they've got the other stuff, and the other stuff just sounds flatter. But to a lot of people, they don't really notice. So yeah, I don't think we had another song. We had Someone Special on the album, which was a pretty strong song, but I think they would have sounded better with Pete Wilson. And I think if we'd been sensible, we would have written something that was a bit like German film star, you know, just to have the brand recognition or whatever it is. But yeah, I mean, I love stuff on it. I love it. And I mean, the experience of recording was interesting, a bit fraught, but interesting. Nigel Gray had a Ferrari sports car. Was it a Dino or something? And he took me for a drive in it once round little country lanes, at least three times the speed I would have thought was remotely sensible. And he had a huge Mercedes limousine, one of the old Grocer. And he drove us up to London once. He was an eccentric character, but he had personal problems. And I just don't think he was as skilled an engineer and producer as Pete Wilson. Not really. There you go. But you live and learn.
So I was going to ask about the tour in Italy, specifically Verona. I don't know, Clive left, I believe. Was that mid-tour though when that happened?
We had three gigs left.
Right.
Three gigs
Gosh.
left, and we'd done a European tour. Things had got a bit. We'd grown apart. There was another person involved. There seems to be some unspoken animus between Clive and Barbara. Possibly, I there was certainly a lot of tension, and it was weird because we'd done. Did we even do the sound check? No, we'd gone to the hotel. And the crew had taken all the gear to the theatre. It was quite a big theatre, a bit like a sort of Hammersmith Odeon or Rainbow type
Wow,
big
yeah.
balconied theatre, old building. And this blazing row in the hotel foyer lobby kicked off. And then at that moment, Mick, the sound man, I think it was, rushed in and said, "The gig's on fire." And the two seemed this incendiary argument and this blaze. I mean, it seemed quite spookily, you know, coincidental.
So it was literally on fire, a flame.
What happened? The electrical system was not good. They
Oh.
tried to blame our lighting engineer, but he was a hugely skilled guy. Fire started somewhere in the stage area. Something electrical started a fire. It went into the air ducts, the ventilation ducts, and apparently they were lined with some sort of fibrous material, which went up like whoosh, you know. The crew were all backstage and on stage, and the fire then went through the ventilation into the ceiling, which was plastic.
Oh.
So when they realized the scale of what was going on, the entire ceiling went up in flames, and they had to get from the stage. They couldn't get backstage. That was on fire. They had to run all the way up through the auditorium, and by this time it was full of smoke. So they ran up through the auditorium, got then to this huge lobby at the front with, you know, which was one of those big crescent-shaped lobbies with glass doors.
Yes, yeah.
That was full of smoke, and they were crawling on the floor trying to find the exits, because and half of them were locked, and they kept trying these glass doors, and they were locked, and they're going to the next one, all crawling around. They got outside, and one of them was missing.
Oh, no.
And they said, as they'd been running up through the theatre, bits of burning plastic from the ceiling were falling. They got out, one of them wasn't there. They're, oh my God, the fire brigade arrived. And then one of the truck doors opened, and the guy who was missing got out. He'd been asleep in the cab of the truck. So thankfully, none of them.
Yes.
They got a couple of school burns, I think, well, minor burns, but I don't think any of them were badly hurt. And our gear was ruined, and that was the end of it. They tried to blame us. Interestingly, years later, it came to light that there was an arsonist in Verona who, a fascist, I think, who was targeting places where young people, where they played music, nightclubs. And apparently there were several fires started by him. So maybe it was him. I don't know. But it's that was the end of it. Yeah. And we, I think we flew home, I think, straight away. We
So,
had two or three more gigs, but
in parallel, so obviously Clive, I think my I read that Clive left on that night. Is that correct?
basically, yeah.
So you had to carry on doing some gigs without him. That was a bit tricky as well.
Well, I mean, that tour being ended then, at least we had a bit of a breather. We came back. What were we going to do? And we had to get another guitarist. Lester Square from the Monochrome set tried out. Great guitarist, but
Yeah.
it wasn't right. And then we met somehow, heard about Kevin Armstrong. And I remember went to meet him in this tiny flat in Brixton. And he was playing me some of his self-written songs on his little four track, and stuff. He was clearly a really good musician. And he learned the set straight away. I mean, in a matter of a week or two, just and could replicate Clive almost perfectly. It was good. So we were able to tour, and then we did write. We used one of his songs for the next album, Love Is Essential. Sanctuary. I mean, his guitar playing is unbelievably good, but he wouldn't mind me saying this, I'm sure, but he wasn't really a band person. He was a gun for hire. He was a skilled musician who would play with whoever and so once he had played with Thomas Dolby before. Once Thomas Dolby asked him back and was doing very well, I think he went with him, and then subsequently did Live Aid with David Bowie, because Thomas Dolby organized the band for that, for Bowie. So
Brilliant.
And we wished him well. I mean, he'd helped us out, and he was brilliant. But then, and Steve then, who he very much was a sort of band person when he came along. Good guitarist, very good, superb drummer, actually. Steve's drumming, you should hear his drumming. He can do John Bonham. And I've heard him in a studio with doing John Bonham's sort of drumming. He is phenomenal. Sadly, no longer with us. But he then saw out the rest of the days of the Passions. Losing Clive was the end, really. I mean, we never wrote anything as good again, and we did lose something. A band has chemistry, and why it clicked when I joined in the first place. We all just had the chemistry, it all worked, we all worked together well. And you can't just take random people out of bands and put any old person in. It doesn't really work like that, you know.
The Sanctuary then seemed to not maybe sell as many as perhaps you'd hoped. There's some great songs on it, but would you put that as a sort of beginning of the end of the band?
Well, I mean, Polydor seemed keen. We got the book studio time. We went to the Garden in East London, which was John Fox's studio from
All
Ultravox,
right. Yeah.
with Mick Glossop. Now, Mick Glossop was a real meat and potatoes rock producer. Really, really good. I mean, and yeah, I think he did a really good job, and he was great at getting good drum sounds and things. I mean, and a good guy to work with. Nice to be around, you know. Yeah, but I think, yeah, I mean, once the album didn't do well, and I mean, why would it have a decent single to play from it? Nothing like German Film Star. Record companies were already talking about the death of the guitar band and that it was all going to be synthesizers. They were already thinking of moving. And it wasn't that much longer. It was early, what, 83, spring 83, that they decided to drop us. And it's why we went to America. We toured America in the vain hope of getting a deal over there because we had some contacts in America, but we didn't. So, yeah, I mean, it was a long, slow decline, really. I mean, German Film Star was the peak.
How did you get then to that final marquee concert from that point?
Well, yeah, I mean, we did this American tour. It all went properly nuts in America, as you can probably imagine. I mean, what an extreme place. We did a lot of gigs around New York, Boston, Washington, Maryland. I forget, up Long Island. We didn't have much luck. I think Barra had a meeting with someone from, was it Phonogram or Polygram in the States, but we couldn't get them to, And people came to see us. I mean, we did some decent shows. We did some good gigs. But when we came back from America, we sort of knew the writing was on the wall. And we were all very disconsolate. And I think Barbara fancied trying something different. And she liked America. I didn't like it, but she liked New York particularly. I think was keen to go back. I remember her coming up. I was living in the same house as them by this time. I remember her coming upstairs, and she came into my room and said, "Do you want to call it a day?" And I felt so down about everything. I just said yes, and I didn't want it trickling on and getting more and more dispiriting, and us going back to playing pubs or something. I just didn't want that. I thought it was better to go out with a bang, you know. So we decided on two shows at the Marquee as a farewell. And they were probably some of the best gigs we ever did. We were on fire. It was brilliant. And we had a friend doing some backing vocals with us, Adele Bertai, who worked with Thomas Dolby, I think, and sung on a few things and had her own material. They were brilliant gigs. They were superb. So at least we went out, doing what we loved doing well. So,
Did they record it?
sadly, no. And that was a trick we missed. But I hear people. We get messages on our Facebook Passions thing. We get messages. But I was at those marquee gigs. They were brilliant and all this, So, yeah, we did something right.
Was awesome. So, did you have a particular song you like playing live, actually?
I liked playing The Swimmer because it was so energetic. Jump for Joy with Kevin Armstrong played Jump for Joy, really. That was good. Bachelor Girls went down well live. And Film Star, of course, as soon as those first chords started, the whole place went mad, So, yeah, I never really liked Skin Deep, to be honest. When it was finished, I didn't really like it. And my regret is that because Clive had that riff, and I did this sort of semi-funk sort of bass thing on it, which I think in retrospect was a real mistake. If I'd played something like I played on German Film Star, actually, it could have been more interesting, I think. But there you go. Yeah, that's the one song I never really liked.
It was a bit out of kilter, to the sort of style of the band's songs, I always thought.
Yeah, and that was probably my fault for, literally, Clive had the guitar. I started playing that do, do, do. And I thought, oh, let's get, yeah. If I'd played do 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 do, it would have been better. It would have been more like a passion song, I think. But there you go.
You still stay in contact with any of the band?
Yep, saw Clive recently. He lives in Hastings, so and I've been I go down to Hastings a fair bit. So yeah, did see him recently. Richard is in Brentford, so I meet up with him occasionally. Barbara's in the States, so very rarely. I saw her, what, 5 years ago or something. She came over. Steve no longer with us. I've not seen Kevin for decades. He lives in Hastings as well, but he's got a kind of mansion in Hastings. So we thought about doing a reunion or something 10 years ago, or maybe a bit more, but didn't really work out. I think unless you can come back and do it with everybody in the same place, but having people on different continents and different towns is, it's not really credible, so.
Well, David, if Oasis could do it, then I'm sure the Passions can too. And, you know, we'd love it if it was part of the, we were the conduit as part of that episode.
Yeah. Maybe, we'll see. Definitely, maybe.
A question we ask all the bands is, what's your favourite memory of your time with the Passions?
I think when I first joined, and once we were rehearsing straight away, we started rehearsing for gigs coming up, and I just loved being in a real band, and they were such good musicians. I mean, Richard was a rock solid metronomic drummer. What a gift for a bass player, because he is right on the beat all the time. Clive knows so much. I learned so much from Clive. But what I really loved was the way they played together. And I've often noticed with amateur musicians, they don't really look at each other, you know, but they all would check each other out on when we were playing. They'd be looking at each other all the time, you know, not continuously, but just little glances, just, you know, make eye contact. Yep, that's good. Yeah, here comes the break. I just found that so inclusive, you know. And so that's my favorite real memory of what it was like to be in the band. Just loved playing, and especially live. I mean, we just played live really well. I think I always say, and I think we all agree, that we always played better live than we did in the studio. So yeah, that sensation of being in a unit that just clicks, you know, was fantastic.
Are you still in music, David?
Well, I
Musical.
tinker. I have a home recording. I tinker with some things. I did an online thing recently with an old friend who is a DJ. I sent him some WAV files, individual tracks from a piece I'd written, an instrumental. But that's quite an interesting experience.
I completely understand. But look, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate you being so open. It's been, you know, a great experience for us. I hope you've enjoyed the process, but thank you so much for joining us. Thank you.
You're very welcome. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Cheers.
Bye-bye.
Cheers. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Uncharted 80s podcast. As you know, we do our research from a variety of sources, but of course, if you want to add any more details to what we talked about, or correct us on anything, then you can of course contact us. Where can they contact us, Noel?
Well, they can contact us on our email address, which is podcast@uncharted80s.com.
Brilliant. Or you can do that via our Facebook group, the Uncharted 80s. Thanks everybody for listening.
Thank you.
Thank you.